Chapter 72. With Michael beside him lugging the carpet bag, which was the heaviest item of luggage, Sean left the buggy and crossed the sidewalk into the offices of the Ladyburg Banking and Trust Company.
"Oh, Colonel Courtney," the young lady at the reception desk enthused. "I'll tell Mr. Pye you're here."
"Please don't bother. I'll carry the glad news myself."
Ronnie Pye looked up in alarm as the door of his office flew open and the two of them walked in.
"Good morning, Ronnie," Sean greeted him cheerfully. "Have you bled any good stones today, or is it still too early?"
Guardedly, Ronnie murmured a reply and stood up. Sean selected a cigar from the leather box on the desk and sniffed it.
"Not a bad line in horse dung you've got here," he remarked, and bit the end off. "Match, please, Ronnie. I'm a customer. Where are your manners?"
Reluctantly, suspiciously, Ronnie lit the cigar for him. Sean sat down and placed his feet on the desk, with ankles neatly crossed.
"How much do I owe you?" he asked.
The question heightened Ronnie's suspicion, and his eyes settled on the carpet bag in Michael's hands.
"You mean altogether, capital and interest?"
"Capital and interest," Sean affirmed. "Well, I'd have to work that out. Give it to me in round figures." "Well, very roughly, you understand, it would be around, oh, I don't know, say,
He paused. That carpet bag looked confoundedly heavy. Its sides bulged, and he could see the tension in Michael's arm muscles as he held it.
Say, £22,816.15.
As he named the exact figure, Ronnie dropped his voice in veneration, the way a primitive tribesman might invoke the name of his god. Sean lowered his feet. Then he leant forward and swept the papers that covered the desk to one side.
"Very well. Pay the man, Michael."
Solemnly, Michael placed the bag in the cleared space. But when Sean winked at him, his solemnity cracked and he grinned. Making no attempt to hide his agitation, Ronnie plunged both hands into the mouth of the bag and withdrew two pouches of unbleached canvas. He loosened the drawstring of one and spilled gold onto his desk.
"Where did you get this?" he demanded angrily.
"At the end of the rainbow."
"There's a fortune here,"
Ronnie protested, as he dipped into the carpet bag again.
"A goodly amount, I'll admit. But...
Ronnie was scratching in the pile of coins, hunting for the secret of their origin like a hen for a worm. However, Sean had spent a week in Johannesburg and another 2 days in Pietermaritzburg, visiting every bank and exchanging small parcels of Kruger coin for Victorian and Portuguese, and the coin of half a dozen other states. For a minute, Sean watched his efforts with a smile of happy contentment. Then he excused himself.
We'll be getting on home now.
Sean placed an arm around Michael's shoulder and led him to the door.
Deposit the balance to my account, there's a good fellow.
Further protests still born on his lips, and despair mingled with frustration, Ronnie Pye watched through the window as Lion Cop Wattle Estates climbed up into the buggy, settled its hat firmly, waved a whip in courteous farewell, and trotted sedately out of his clutches. All that summer, the hills of Lion Kop echoed to the thud of axes and the singing of hundreds of Zulus. As each tree toppled and fell in a froth of heaving branches, men with cane knives moved forward to strip the rich bark and tie it in bundles. Every train that left for Pietermaritzburg towed truckloads of it to the extract plant. Each long day together strengthened the bonds between Sean and Michael. They evolved a language of their own, notable only for its economy of words. Without lengthy discussion, each took charge of a separate sphere of Lion Cop activity. Michael made himself responsible for the maintenance of equipment, the loading and dispatch, all the paperwork and the ordering of material. At first, Sean surreptitiously checked his work, but when he found no fault in it, he no longer bothered. They parted only at the end of each week. Sean to Pietermaritzburg, for obvious reasons, and Michael to Tunaskral in duty. Michael hated those returns home. He hated Anna's endless accusations of disloyalty and her occasional fits of weeping. But even worse was the silent reproach in Gary's face. Early each Monday morning, with the joy of a released convict, he set off for Lion Cop and Sean's welcome.
"What about those bloody axe handles, Mike?"
Only in the evenings they talked freely, sitting together on the stoop of the homestead. They spoke of money and war and politics and women and wattle, and they talked as equals without reserve, as men who worked together with a common purpose. Dirk sat quietly in the shadows and listened to them. 15 years old, but Dirk had a capacity for hatred out of all proportion to his age, and he used it all on Michael. Sean's handling of Dirk was in no way different. His school attendance was still spasmodic. He trailed Sean about the plantations and received his full share of rough affection and even rougher discipline. Yet he sensed in the relationship between Sean and Michael a terrible threat to his security. Merely by reason of age and experience, he was excluded from the evening discussions on the stoop. His few contributions were received with indulgent attention. Then the talk would be resumed as though he had not spoken. Dirk sat quietly planning in lurid detail his assassination of Michael. On Lion Kop that summer, there were small thefts and unexplained acts of vandalism, all of which affected only Michael. His best riding boots vanished. His single dress shirt was ripped down the back when he came to don it for the monthly dance at the schoolhouse. His pointer bitch whelped a litter of 4 puppies, which survived only a week before Michael found them dead in the straw of the barn. Ada and her young ladies began preparing for the Christmas of 1904 in the middle of December. As their guests, Ruth and Storm, came down from Pietermaritzburg on the 20th, and Sean's frequent absences from Lion Kop left a heavy burden of work on Michael. There was an air of mystery in the Proteus Street cottage. Sean was strictly excluded from the long sessions in Ada's private rooms, where she and Ruth retired to plan the wedding dress. But this was not the only secret. There was something else, which was keeping all the young ladies in fits of suppressed giggles and excitement. With a little eavesdropping, Sean gathered it was something to do with his Christmas present from Ruth. However, Sean had other worries, chief of which was maintaining his position in the fierce competition for Miss Storm Friedman's favours. This included a heavy expenditure on sweetmeats, which were delivered to Storm without Ruth's knowledge. The Shetland pony had been left in Pietermaritzburg, and Sean was required to substitute at the cost of his dignity and grass stains on the knees of his breeches. As reward, he was invited to take tea each afternoon with Storm and her dolls. Favourite among all Storm's dolls was a female child with human hair and an insipid expression on its large china face. Storm wept with a broken heart when she found that china head shattered into many pieces. With Sean's help, she buried it in the backyard, and then stripped Ada's garden of flowers for the grave. Sullenly, Dirk watched the funeral. Storm was now completely reconciled to her loss, and so thoroughly enjoyed the ceremony that she insisted Sean exhume the body and start again. In all, the doll was buried 4 times, and Ada's garden looked as though a swarm of locusts had descended upon it.